Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, our national challenge to face the rise of American fascism in the Trump era. My guest, Professor Henry Giroux. He holds the Global Television Network Chair of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster's University in Ontario, Canada, and is one of our most articulate activist scholars. He is a thought leader, a prolific writer, critiquing American politics, culture, and education. He was previously the Waterbury Chair Professor at Penn State University and Director of the Forum in Education and Cultural Studies. Professor Giroux is a leader in the field of critical and public examination of our issues, and he looks at the nature of a spectacle in our new media, body politic, and cultural affairs. He's a prominent advocate of radical democracy, which opposes the powers of neoliberalism, corporatism, and religious fundamentalism that diminishes our sense of civic virtue and free thought and well-being. He has also been named among the top 50 educational thinkers of the modern period. He is the author of many books. His most recent is The Terror of the Unforeseen, that deconstructs the emergence of a popular neoliberal fascism in our present age of disposability, where personal freedoms and democracy are disposable. His website is Henry A. Giroux, that's GIROUX.com. Nice to have you with us today, Henry.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program. It's been a while. Right now, we are witnessing an explosion of protests and demonstrations across the country. Several hundred cities in every state are now witnessing demonstrations, by the way, most peaceful, but some are also violent. And I don't want us to conflate the peaceful protesters who have a legitimate grievance. And this is long overdue. This is the culmination, the tipping point where enough's enough, where people are simply saying, this has gone on for too long. There's been no reform. There's been no change. There has been no understanding of why we are such a racist society. And while this has gone on, we're saying we're not going to allow it to go unnoticed, and hence moving into the streets. But there's another group who are there coming from other locations more often than not, who are not there to grieve the person who was killed, not to address the inappropriate behavior of our laws and the high rate of convictions for crimes that should never have been made a crime in the first place. In any case, then there are those who come to loot. Again, they're not there as a part of a civil rights movement. They're not part of a black justice movement. And unfortunately, where we were all of one mind that this was a crime against this person, now there's divisiveness. But unlike other demonstrations in the past, many are rather unique and reflect the wider polarization and hatred that has been fuming in the collective unconscious of the nation, and especially since Trump entered office. For example, many cases are being reported of agent provocateurs, including the police themselves, damaging buildings and setting fires in order to blame demonstrators. And the NBC report found that some of the white supremacist groups which support Trump and who Trump eggs on are fueling violence under the guise of Antifa, which is otherwise a radical left-wing group. We are also witnessing black Americans trying to stop whites from violence and looting and demanding peaceful demonstrations. Black Lives Matter takes its inspiration from Martin Luther King. And finally, yesterday, Trump further assumed his role as the mad emperor after hiding in a bunker as police tear gassed peaceful protesters, then held up a Bible and incited the police to further violence based upon his authority. You recently wrote that the Trump administration now, quote, believes that blacks are more dangerous than right-wing terrorists, neo-Nazis, and white supremacists, end quote. So we are now observing many police forces and right-wing militia groups morphing into Trump's very own brown shirts. Racism has been fuming in our society for many decades, and all the more recent administrations have completely failed to deal with the problems in racial inequality in schools, higher education, and social needs, and equal opportunity and salaries in the workplace. Obviously, the more Trump can fuel instability, the greater are the chances he will be able to call on the elections or demand some executive power through the Supreme Court that he controls in order to cancel elections and remain in office. Those are purely speculative on my part. And the two main questions I have, and take your time, please, in giving us the larger, deeper context, is how do we get into this tipping point of social collapse, and towards what end are the violent divisions in American protests and the government's response heading? The forum is yours.
Well, I think that we've had 40 years of an economic system that has produced enormous poverty, misery, anguish, the daily harassment and brutality waged against people of color, whether we're talking about the undocumented immigrants at the border and the caging of their children, or whether we're talking about the expansion of a mass incarceration system, which is basically aimed at black and brown people, or we're talking about massive inequality, which has reached a point that is more shameful and shocking than one could even imagine. Four families in the United States control half the wealth of the bottom half of the United States. We're talking about people who are unemployed. We're talking about jobs that have disappeared because of global capitalism. We're talking about the financialization of the market. And I think in many ways, you know, you combine this massive death machine that neoliberalism has produced over the last 40 years with these increasing acts of brutality, this increasing language of war, you know, this increasing attempt on the police to be egged on by Trump to basically commit acts of violence. And then all of a sudden, you see, all across the world, a video that so symbolizes the tyranny of the state. Somebody puts his knee on a black man until he dies 9 minutes, as if that knee becomes an arrogant symbol of the long legacy of and justification for slavery, for lynching, for Jim Crow, segregation, the constant assaults on America. And I think that if we're going to talk about violence, we have to be careful here, because it seems to me that, well, I understand the concern for looting, and I'll get looted, and I'm putting that in parentheses. I'll talk about that in a minute. The real violence is not what's basically happening when somebody breaks into Target or smashes a few windows. The real violence in this country is being waged by a president who believes in violence, that basically has cut food stamps for children, that basically has destroyed the social state, that basically is destroying the environment, that basically is embracing fascist leaders all over the world while ignoring those countries that basically have a legacy of democratic ideals. So it seems to me, let's be careful. I mean, we're going to talk about violence. Let's not equate what's happening in the streets with a state that is engaging in massive degrees of violence. And it seems to me, more recently, a president who has now declared war on his own people. I mean, he's been waiting for this war for a long time, and he finally got it. I mean, here's a guy who talks about violence in the streets, and all of a sudden, before a photo op, basically sends out the military who beat, maced, and basically assaulted a group of peaceful demonstrators so that Trump could basically appear before a church holding up a Bible and claiming he was the president of law and order. So I think that's the first issue. In other words, the systemic racism, the massive inequality, these have been going on for a long time, and they've reached a tipping point. People are tired. The system doesn't work. The justice system is on the side of the rich. The social contract has been destroyed. Social provisions are being eliminated. It's very difficult for people to survive today. Too many people. The other side of this is that the demonstrations that are taking place and the constant reference on the part of the media to the notion of looting is simply a diversionary tactic, and it feeds the right. If you want to talk about looting, then you really want to talk about the pharmaceutical companies that killed millions of people, it seems to me, by pushing drugs, opioid drugs, knowing that those drugs basically would kill people. If you want to talk about violence, talk about the way in which the banks in 2008 caused a financial crisis that exploited vulnerable people and ended up in many ways being bailed out for the misery that they caused, where thousands, hundreds of thousands of people lost their homes and many ended up in the streets. You want to talk about violence, talk about the poverty we have in this country and what it's doing to people, people who have to make a choice between medicine and food. You want to talk about violence, talk about a healthcare system that is more concerned about profit than it is about human needs and denies people absolutely essential services because it's too expensive and they don't want to pay the cost. That's what violence is about. As far as what's going on in the street and this kind of looting that we're talking about, I mean, these groups in many ways are a sideshow. They don't represent the vast majority of people who are protesting, and they don't deserve the attention that they're getting. And I think that in many ways, we have to put this all in context. We don't know if it's being caused by the right. We don't know. It certainly is not some mystical left-wing group that has mobilized hundreds of thousands of people across the country in a way to suggest that Amphitai is the source of these demonstrations. It's just nonsense. I mean, you have a president who lies. You have a president who's obsessed with himself. You have a president who represents the pinnacle, the apathy, the apotheosis of corporate interest. And you have a state that's now basically run by corporations. So when we're going to talk about violence and we're going to talk about protest, let's talk about the history and the conditions that produce that violence and why that violence is taking place. It seems to me they're the essential questions to be asked.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. But we have had police violence simply as a manifestation of the violence of the state and government. And I'd like you to draw a connection between the violence of the government and how it is being expressed through law enforcement. But before then, I want to spread this discussion out over even a larger canvas. In the past 30 years, look at our efforts in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, and also in other countries destabilizing their democratically elected governments, even supporting Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates in their attacks against the poorest country in the Middle East. And when you consider that almost 19 million people are food insecure, with hundreds of thousands having cholera or died from cholera, and we, the United States, our politicians, the members of our entire complex in Washington, meaning the State Department, the Defense Department, the National Security Agency, the CIA, the White House, all of these individuals, we're talking about tens of thousands of individuals collectively have known how bad Yemen is, how their children are suffering, people are dying. And yet we have not shed a tear. We've done not a single thing to stop this conflict. Saudi Arabia is now bringing it down a little bit because they were running short on money. And they have reached no goal in 4 years except destroying a people there. No one talked about this in the American media. I mean, no one for 3 years. You didn't hear a word. And even to denounce it or even to support it, it was just no one discussed it. No one discussed our what we did with Syria or taking care of Gaddafi and the destruction of the number one country in Africa. There are 54 countries in Africa. His was number one, longest-lived people, highest income, healthiest people, best educated, higher percentage of education and literacy than in the United States, and no debt. And yet Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, we destroyed them. We used NATO and we destroyed the country, and now it's a basket case. So when we look around us, we look beyond the ghettoization of our communities. We never look, never do we see a protest outside of Goldman Sachs or the venture capitalists that cause companies that have been here for dozens, even 100 or more years, to be purchased, stripped down, and the product taken over to China, India, Haiti, someplace, and the product made cheaply and then brought back into our box stores. When a person's buying a pair of Nikes, they never look at someone earning 20 cents an hour for Nike, and then Nike giving millions of dollars to Colin Kaepernick, who can then talk about, you know, justice. Well, where's the justice when he receives millions of dollars for virtue shaming? And yet, does he look at where the money that he is making comes from by exploitation? So there seems to be none of this self-reflection, no honest and introspection about how we are one of the most violent countries in the history of the world. Look at what we do to other people. Then look what we do at our own middle class. Look at the jobs when people say, well, gee whiz, in Newark and Camden, New Jersey, Compton, Detroit, and all these other cities, Baltimore, that have had such hard times where people don't have work, or if they do, it's minimal wage work. And then we blame them for their poverty. We blame them for their crime. We never blame the people who made those decisions to take corporations out of that community that provided work, that provided income, that provided good schools, and to export it out. They're never held accountable. Bill Clinton did it. Ronald Reagan did it. Obama did it. Bush did it. They all did it. Making crimes that would put millions of African-American people of color and Caucasians in prison for years, when all three presidents, Bush, Clinton, and Obama, admitted doing drugs. They admitted doing the drugs that they then turned around and put other people in prison for doing the same drugs. So when I look at this problem, I'm not looking at just one man dying, a man who was innocent, a man who had a $20 bill that happened to have been a forgery. He didn't know it was a forgery. You know, and normally what they do, they just confiscate your $20 bill or $10 bill, and then you give them the rest of the money, and then they turn that into the bank, or where they turn it in as a forgery. And then they called the police, and the police came and took the man out of his car at gunpoint. Since when would anyone, any Caucasian, any business person, any family person be taken out of a car because they tried to buy something with a $20 bill that was a forgery, no fault of their own? So this entire system, the militarization of our life, the hyper-masculinity issues, the feeling that we can go anywhere and do anything we want, and there's no accountability. No one's going to be held accountable. And even though they've engaged in breaking international treaties, they've engaged in crimes against humanity, they never have to worry because they are the deep state, and no one ever touches the deep state. Now you have a much bigger backdrop to give your analysis on. Please take it from there.
Well, I think to go back to the first question about the police violence and what that means and why. How do we talk about its intensity? I mean, look, you know, you have the state generally, in its most ideal way, functions to have around two registers. At one level, there's the social state and there's the punishing state. And when there's some kind of balance of sorts, they kind of are not out of whack with each other, regardless of how we want to talk about the whether they're effective and what they do. But I think increasingly in the last 40 years, as the social state is eliminated, as the welfare state is attacked, as every public good that we know that creates the capacity for people to be critically engaged citizens begins to disappear, you have the rise of the punishing state. And what does that mean? That means that the police are given more resources. That means that problems that basically have nothing to do with crime are criminalized. Now it becomes a crime to be poor. It becomes a crime to be homeless. Kids in schools occupy spaces largely occupied in many ways by the police. Trivial infractions are now treated as if they're crimes, and kids are handcuffed and put in the back of police cars and taken off. And so you have this punishment creep that sort of seeps over the entire culture and becomes an organizing principle for governing society. And we see that now in its end point with the full-fledged war on people of color. It's just so blatant, so obvious, and primarily because we have a media, a technology that's capable in many ways of capturing it. If George Floyd's death had not been photographed and not been videoed, nobody would have cared, and nobody would have seen it. They wouldn't have cared because they wouldn't have seen it. But I think the other question that you're raising is that, look, let's be honest. I mean, the United States is not a democracy. as my friend Noam Chomsky has said, it's constantly voted as one of the most dangerous countries in the world. We have a long history that makes that obvious, of which you repeated in the last 10 minutes, and I don't need to repeat, whether we're talking about wars abroad or we're talking about supporting dictators or we're talking about basically engaging in criminal behavior with a whole range of unscrupulous actors from rogue banks to selling arms abroad. We're the largest arms dealer in the world. So it seems to me that what we're now seeing is that you can't understand American foreign policy and its utter retreat from democracy and its militarized mentality. You can't separate that from what's going on at home. The war abroad is now part of the war at home. And I think the inference that we have to get from that is stop equating capitalism and democracy. This is not a democracy. It's a warfare state. It's a rogue state. It's a failed state. And it will do everything it can, utilizing all the force it can, to maintain its power. And I think once we begin to understand that, we can begin to understand the language, the interventions, the threads that run through these various forms of domination, how they work. And we can see through the language that people like Trump use who claim that force is on the side of justice. Not on the side of justice, on the side of power. So I think that's a very important issue.
In your writings, you're fond of quoting Hannah Arendt and her deep insights into the origins of nature and the fascistic psyche. And you've also stated in the past Americans suffer from historical amnesia.
Yeah.
So as a nation, we look like historical illiterates. That's my own personal opinion.
I think you've hit on something very important that needs to be mentioned. Look, if one of the things that authoritarians hate is they hate the concept of historical memory. They hate the concept of historical consciousness for two reasons. One, history always can be a repository for making clear what repression looks like and how it's developed at other times in other historical contexts, and that's dangerous. And secondly, history, in a sense, it's very difficult to consistently rewrite it without it being challenged. And that's essentially what we're now seeing all over the world, places like Poland, places like Hungary, places like Brazil. And to rewrite that history is basically an act of or to deny it is an act of depoliticization. It's a way to depoliticize the population. It's a way to produce the conditions that eliminate people from becoming agents. You can't be an agent without a sense of historical consciousness. You can't have a sense of context without a sense of historical consciousness. And if you don't have a sense of context, you can't understand basically in any way, it seems to me, the kinds of problems that we're facing. So it seems to me that there are two issues that we're talking about here. We're talking about, one, how important historical memory is as a repository for creating critically engaged people. And secondly, we're talking about the question of agency and what that means. You can't have a democracy without informed people. I'm sorry. It doesn't work that way. And you can't have informed people without public goods and institutions that provide the critical modes of education that allow people to think, to weigh evidence, to engage in serious arguments, to read, to be literate. The United States has become one of the most civically illiterate countries in the world. We basically live in a culture of immediacy, consumerism, reality TV, and game shows. This is a country that collapses politics into entertainment and then uses entertainment as a form of politics, as we have seen absolutely day in and day out for the last 4 years with Trump. And so it seems to me that education here becomes really central to politics. How we talk about history, how we talk about agency, how we talk about vision, how we talk about solidarity, how we talk about what's happening in this country, all becomes meaningless if we don't stress the crucial nature and importance of education and informing people so they can understand the problem in order to address it, in order to transform it, in order to offer resistance to it.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. And let's take a look at your concept of age of disposability. What does that mean, and how does it relate to the allegiances and actions of our government that favor Wall Street and the corporate elite and the private and federal military complex over democracy and civic responsibility to protect average citizens and right now minority groups? But keep this also in focus. where
I think that, you know, you've touched upon something that's really crucial here, and that is you have a country that's on the side of social amnesia. It's basically on the side of historical and social amnesia. It's a country filled with disimagination machines. And these disimagination machines perform a very crucial educational function. They function to keep people stupid. They function to keep people uninformed. They function to keep people in fear. They function to keep people anxious, waiting to basically give up their own sense of agency to some leader who's going to stand on a podium and say, "I'm the only one who can solve your problems. You know, I'm your Führer. You know, I'm the one you should invest in. Don't read anything else. Everything else is fake news. Don't think about evidence. Evidence doesn't matter. Science is a joke. Anybody who comes after me is part of a conspiracy to sort of unravel me. Let me entertain you with stupid stories and fake ideas. Let me tell you things that, like, let me say that there's a radio host recently who 15 years ago assassinated his secretary, and now that's a real thing we need to focus on. I mean, imagine, in the midst, over 100,000 people have died in this country. The economy is tanking. The threat of ecological devastation is overwhelming. We're on the brink of a nuclear war in some cases with Iran or with China or even Russia. And this guy is tweeting, no less, to say the least, every day, far right-wing lunatics who are saying things like the members of the Democratic Party should die. They should be killed. Or he's tweeting right-wing racist commentaries that go on and on. So I guess we're in the midst, in a sense, of a crisis of agency, which is traced to a crisis of politics. We've lost the public goods. They've been privatized and commodified that basically educate people. The only hope we have now are basically around the alternative media, which have the courage, though are really hopeful in many ways, marginalized, to be able to get the truth out, to talk to people, to educate them. And so this fight is really not just a fight over power. It's a fight over consciousness. It's a fight over the ability for people to be self-reflective, to exercise the capacities, in a sense, to understand something about the problems that bear down on their lives, understanding the importance of having compassionate relationships with others, and the importance of what it means to take seriously having a sense of shared responsibility rather than a sense of shared fears with other people. Hate doesn't bring people together. Bigotry doesn't bring people together. Hate and bigotry and violence are not the foundations of a democracy. They're the foundations of fascism. And I think we need to recognize that we're in the abyss. We have fallen over the cliff. And it's time to rethink what it means to get that back.
When we take a look at the coronavirus and really look at the medicine, the science, the independent science, not that coming from one of the Bill Gates controlled organizations, which is wanting to make a mandatory COVID vaccine, or one from the World Health Organization or Anthony Fauci, but really looking at the actual science, we see that it is a real virus, and it can kill people and has, who are sick and have comorbidities, who are old. The average age of the first group who died were 80 years of age in Italy. And in the United States, the 35 to 50% of people who died in nursing homes. All the people in some nursing homes died because of it, but they were there dying in any case.
That's right.
But it has literally turned our society upside down and give unprecedented power, in effect making like Mayor Cuomo or Governor Cuomo a little dictator. You know, he has now the power to do anything he wants, and that's shocking. So do you observe any indication that this pandemic is being manipulated in any way to further a totalitarian agenda to displace democracy?
Oh, I mean, this pandemic offers enormous opportunities for surveillance on the part of the state, increased surveillance. It offers enormous opportunities to atomize people and to separate them. It offers enormous opportunities for businesses to be destroyed and taken over by corporations that will then eliminate. They claim that 45% of all small businesses will not come back, as you know. Those jobs will be eliminated. I think the propensity and the conditions for this pandemic to translate into particular forms of authoritarianism, we've already seen this happen. We're seeing it happen already. It's happening in Hungary. It's happening in Poland. It's happening in Turkey, where they're taking very, very specific steps in terms of mobilizing the military, getting rid of people that they don't like, shutting down the press, claiming it's a threat not to democracy, but to public health. I mean, so I think when you have, remember, all crises represent fertile grounds for both tyranny and the possibility of liberation, the possibility of rethinking what these societies are about. And I think in many ways, you know, when Trump says that the pandemic represents that it's a war, there we go again, right? I mean, all of a sudden, what is in fact a public health crisis and a crisis of economics and a crisis of poverty and a crisis that speaks to an attack on public goods now is militarized. Now it becomes a war, an invisible enemy, as he puts it. Well, when you talk about a war, you're talking about weapons. You're talking about hypermasculinity. You're talking about soldiers. You're talking about the language of death machines. That's what you're talking about. And it seems to me that the more these pandemics create a crisis that capitalism takes advantage of and does little to basically stop. Remember, here is a president who has the governors fighting with each other. Here is a president who, in the midst of a pandemic, has no national plan. Here is a president who refuses to mobilize the National Defense Act so as to provide the goods that people need so they won't be risking their lives. Here is a president who basically thrives on divisiveness and crises, who is doing nothing to address this and making it worse, endlessly making it worse. And it seems to me, what's the end point of this? Well, the end point of this is that people who are most vulnerable, and it's not just people who are old, we're talking about the toll that's been taken on black and brown populations, the toll that's being taken on people who are poor, the toll who are taken on people who can't stay home and you know, work at home on their computers. We're talking about people who are the essential people who make this economy work, people who serve other human beings. And so it seems to me this is a class war. The pandemic has offered the possibility for intensifying the class war. That's what it's done. Now, whether it's going to end up there is another question, but I think you've raised the question that needs to be raised, and that is, to what degree is it conceivable that this feeds the possibilities for tyranny? And I think that's an essential question that has to be asked.
Well, especially since New York State Bar Association this week recommended that the new COVID-19 vaccine be mandatory, that every single person, every resident of New York State must have the vaccine with no exceptions. Now, that is tyranny, because we should have some sanctity over our body. We should have a right to our freedom of choice, and yet that's been taken away from us.
I'm not sure that's about freedom of choice. In the midst of a virus that kills people and can be spread by people who are not symptomatic, it's public health measures matter. I mean, the real question here is to make the vaccine mandatory, but at the same time to say, hey, look, you know, there are exceptions to this, and this should be part of a public debate. We should talk about this. I mean, are there people who might have to take this vaccine who could die from it? Of course there are. I mean, I have an autoimmune disease. I have Crohn's disease. You know, I have to take Remicade treatments. My immune system is vulnerable. Can I get that vaccine? Do I want it mandatory for me without a discussion about what that means? No, absolutely not.
But, of course, once it's mandatory, there's no opportunity for an open forum and discussion.
I think what I'm saying is that one can understand the necessity to push a vaccine that can save lives. What I don't agree with is to push a vaccine and make it mandatory without a public discussion about what that means. And
I agree.
To being violated, and what exceptions would have to apply to something of that sort. I mean,
Richard,
look, I'm sorry. I believe people should get measles shots, you know, smallpox shots. There are vaccines that save lives, and when you don't get them, you endanger other people's lives. And it seems to me we have to talk about this. I mean, the real question here is not how important is your own self-interest around the question of choice. The real issue is, how do you talk about the public good and choice at the same time? How do you do that?
I agree, but here's what's left out of all discussions, including what you just mentioned. Everyone in America was pro-vaccine. In fact, you've had almost no anti-vaccine. What you have are people who are questioning the safety or efficacy of the vaccines that they took, including board-certified pediatricians who I filmed and interviewed on this very topic, who gave vaccines to their own children, including the MMR vaccine and the hepatitis B vaccine, and came down, their children came down with various neurological problems, including autism. And so when you look at how many people have been damaged who don't have
a
voice.
Hold on, Gary. Gary, look, I'm not going to buy into the logic that vaccines cause autism. I don't think there's scientific evidence for that. And I don't like the anti-vaccine movement. I'm afraid I'm not in that camp. And it seems to me the vast majority of people who are talking about vaccines are not the people who are interviewed in that camp. So who have reputable reputations. So it seems to me that this question of the, if we want to talk about vaccines, I want to put the question of vaccine into a broader perspective. And I want to know what that means in relation to government power. I want to know what that means in relation to public health. And I want to know what that means in relation to the vast majority of scientific evidence that's available. That's what I want to do.
That's fair enough. Would you be open or willing to examine the 50 articles that Richard and I have written on this since I was pro-vaccine, he was pro-vaccine, until we started to see anomalies that weren't being answered by the very establishments like the CDC that oversaw it and what evidence was presented?
I think those debates have to be taken up in a public forum. Absolutely. You bet. They should be taken up in a public forum. They shouldn't be marginalized. And they should be something that everybody should be aware of in terms of how they end up and how they're worked out in the long run.
I agree with you. It's just that we who have done the actual research and presented information to share, invite on a program, and then we are not invited on the program. The people who are pro-vaccine are. The New York Times will not interview people like that. But again, that's a separate issue than what we're discussing. This was merely the idea that if there's a vaccine that is made by Merck, and I just wrote an article on Merck and its whole sordid history and all the things it's been found guilty of and how many people have died because of Vioxx that they created. Now, that's not speculation. These are actual court cases and outcomes.
I mean, the issue that I'm concerned about, I'm at a university that represents one of the foremost universities in the world around immunological treatments. And I know this. I know there is enormous support here for taking plasma and using it as a way to treat people who basically are suffering from the coronavirus. The real question for me is this going to be put on the market or is this going to be available for free? That's the question I'm concerned about. The real question for me are these vaccines going to be pushed around economic interest, which makes me very suspicious of both the vaccine and the interest that is pushing them, or are we going to translate this discourse into a larger public health issue and a public good issue? That's the concern I have. I'm concerned about how capitalism takes even the most valuable forms of medicine that everybody should have. Everybody should have that malaria drug if it works. You know, and they're in a country where that drug is spreading. It seems to me, but when we start assigning these drugs to companies that then put out all kinds of nonsense for advertising and then charge enormous amounts of money, I mean, drugs that are available that can cure particular cancers that are just simply too, they can't be bought. You know, they're like, you know, what, I mean, let me give you an example. A Remicade treatment in Canada, each treatment is $5,500. $5,500. If I didn't have that treatment, I couldn't function. People often say to me, why don't you come to the United States? And I say, I won't come to the United States because you don't have a national health service. I wouldn't do it. If I were in the United States, I'd be bankrupt.
And those are fair and legitimate concerns. Are we profiting off these drugs? And this is a separate issue that I would look at of the efficacy and safety and exploiting the people. If we cared about people being healthy, we would have universal health care in the United States, and we do not. There were more bankruptcies because of people's medical bills for over 20 years than there was up until the subprime mortgage crisis 2007 and 2008, and then that became the number one cause of bankruptcies. Now it'll be the COVID virus and people losing their income. But right now, when people lose their income, they frequently lose their health insurance in the United States, and 20 million Americans who had some form of health insurance now don't. So therefore, they cannot afford to be sick, and yet no one in Congress is promoting the idea that we should have a universal health care like other countries do, and they do very well with them. But ours is all about the profit at every level. So I'm concerned, as you're concerned, and legitimately so. You're for something, and before I'm for something, I just want to look at the science. But I'm going to use my, as a scientist, and I'm a scientist, I want to look at my ability to look at something and see, does it meet the criteria that I could accept as being legitimate? Because one of the things I showed is that Merck, that is very powerful, like Monsanto, that was very powerful, and DuPont, they all lost massive suits where they had known the truth and withheld the truth, and then when the public finally got cancers or something wrong, they had to pay enormous settlements. Look, Monsanto just settled 80,000 lawsuits last week, 80,000 for $10 billion. And part of the reason they had to settle is because information came out that they had known for 15 years that glyphosate was a carcinogen and multiple carcinogens that could create this Roundup, the spray. And yet it had been at the top of everyone's, you know, how good they are, but they weren't. Merck the same way. And why I'm concerned about the COVID vaccine, I would be the first person, Henry, to support a COVID vaccine if it could be shown to be legitimate, meaning efficacy, creating positive protective antibodies, and it was safe. And who wouldn't? That's a reasonable position to take. The trouble is we've been told time and again that something, a drug, or some medical procedure is safe. We use it for decades, then find out, like synthetic hormone replacement therapy for women, that it hurt people. I believe what we need is independent people who are not affiliated with any financial group like Wall Street or pharmaceutical group that can do an independent scientific evaluation to see if something should be in the public interest, in which case then following your logic, which I would agree with, should be made available so people don't go broke getting something that could be life-saving. Your thoughts, please.
I don't disagree with this at all. I mean, I'm with you. I mean, I think that capitalism basically subverts the possibility of the truth. I think that the drive for profits can result in medicines and everything else being produced that is unsafe and hidden from the public because of the need to accumulate capital. I don't trust big pharmaceutical companies whatsoever. I think there should be independent public boards to be able to evaluate this stuff to make sure that it's safe. I have no trouble with that. But I think that what we're basically talking about here, we're talking about an economic system that's rigged, that you can't trust regardless of the kinds of products that it produces. That's what we're talking about. And now we're also talking about the social cost of that. And the social cost are not just simply in medicines that basically can kill people because they're put on the market just simply to make money. We're talking about the inequality that is responsible for basically creating these companies and what that inequality means as you spread the net out in the map of the consequences that it produces: misery, poverty, inadequate health care, inadequate child support, child care, I mean, inadequate food shortages, lack of housing. I mean, we're in the midst in the United States of a crisis so severe. This is such a perfect storm that it's a game changer. And it's either going to push us further into a form of authoritarianism that is almost unrecognizable from the past, or there's going to be massive rebellions and an attempt to change the system and to recognize that capitalism and democracy are not the same. They're not the same. We need a democratically socialist society, and we need political parties and social movements outside of the established parties. These parties are wedded to one party is wedded to racial cleansing and to wealth. The other party is wedded to a liberal platform that says minorities are okay sometimes, but it's still wedded to Goldman Sachs. Doesn't work.
You're absolutely right. In fact, Barack Obama, the first thing he did was bring in the head of Citicorp as an advisory group to select his entire cabinet, and because he had a very nice demeanor, a very pleasant personality, we don't then question, look at the people we actually put in positions of policy making, and then you see that in many respects the Democratic Party has failed the original virtues of being a liberal party for many decades. In fact, I'd like you, if you would please, to talk about the death, or at least my perception of the death of the Democratic Party, which is something that Chris Hedges and William Robinson and many others have been addressing for a long time now, and no one pays attention to this. If people had paid attention to many of the progressive intellectuals years ago, what we are observing now would not come as a surprise. It was all very predictable, and even back at the end of the Clinton White House. And I see the Trump phenomena as a virulent virus that was engineered earlier during the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administration. So from your perspective, Henry, please allow us to understand how you see what happened to the Democratic Party contributing, if you believe it does, to the specter of fascism before us today.
Well, the Democratic Party basically has reinforced in many ways some of the worst features of neoliberalism. Basically, it's contributed massively to the crushing and crippling inequality that we see in the country. I mean, remember what Clinton did. I mean, the Glass-Steagall Act was eliminated. I mean, Clinton surrounded himself basically with corporate executives. Obama came along. Who does he hire? Larry Summers. He hires people from the major banks and hedge funds. I mean, these are the financial elite. These are not people who are concerned about democracy. I mean, Clinton comes along, and what does he produce? He produces a welfare-to-work law that's punishing for the poor. He increases mass incarceration by basically mimicking the Republicans' argument for law and order. Clinton comes along, and he's constantly compromising with the Republicans. Every time they put up a fight, he compromised. He had no backbone. I mean, Joe Biden just hired on Larry Summers. Larry Summers. Oh, my God. I mean, you know, what does that say about Biden? What does it say about the Democratic Party? Hillary Clinton makes a speech before she got defeated claiming she has two discourses, one for the corporations and one for the public. I mean, it seems to me the Democratic Party has increasingly bought on to Ronald Reagan's sort of view of Hayek, Reagan, Milton Friedman. All of these people were in the service of the financial elites. All these people basically surrendered their integrity, their sense of agency, and they divorced themselves from working class people, from blacks, from minorities, and essentially created the conditions for Trump. We all know that. Trump is a symptom. That's all. And the Democratic Party, it seems to me, is just as complicitous in producing what the conditions that ended up with Trump as anybody else.
Well, I'm saddened to read much of far-right conservative media that conflates the ideas of Marxism, socialism, communism, fascism, as if these are all synonyms. It is as if these writers are completely clueless about the definitions of these isms, let alone having never read any of its literature. It is absent any moral responsibility, and it's the kind of illiteracy on the right, and many liberal and corporate Democrats as well, who are unable to discern what is unfolding before their eyes because they're not a part of it. You mentioned Hillary Clinton had two voices that she spoke through. One was when she was paid, her and her husband, very large amounts to talk to Wall Street. And the other is when she was trying to convince people that she was like them. Well, like them, there's about 70 million professional class in the United States. That includes 10 million millionaires, 17 million professionals, those who have a higher education, have a larger income status, and their families. If you add all those 17 million professionals, lawyers, doctors, engineers, scientists, if you add in the 10 million millionaires and their families, you're about 70 million people. These are not the people who have to struggle with the idea, do I have enough food today, and what will happen if someone gets sick? And so what I am seeing now is I'm seeing a younger generation that has been mobilized by these protests, and they represent something beyond the Clintons, beyond the Trumps, beyond the radical right and left. They represent a very diverse group of ethnicity, races, gender, class status that are unified by one common ethos, and that is their futures have stripped away from them, been stripped away, by decades of neglect on the behest of the neoliberal capitalism and greed, and together they share in this existential angst that leads to further misery. They have nothing to lose because the duopoly that runs Washington has completely betrayed them, and they're smart enough and aware enough to say, we're not going to take it anymore. Kind of reminds me of many of us in the 1960s. Your final thoughts, please.
I think you're right. I think young people have looked around and they realize that in this age of precarity and uncertainty and massive inequality, their future has been canceled out. These are young people that realize that they don't have a future in this country as it's currently constructed. And I think that many of them, whether we're talking about the young people who are protesting gun violence or the teachers and the young teachers who are walking out of schools all across the country in the last year or so, or whether we're talking about the massive ecological movement, the movement for ecological justice, the green movement. I mean, all these people are now, are coming together and realizing that the traditional forms of intervention, of exercising some sort of collective agency, doesn't work, and that you can't isolate these issues. These issues have to be brought together. These movements have to be brought together. Many young people are now participating with movements all across the globe. These movements are becoming international because the threads that run through them all are very similar and will affect everybody, whether we're talking about the threat of nuclear war or ecological destruction or the refusal to deal with, create an international health center to deal with pandemics. It seems to me that there is something new here. There really is a very different sense of what resistance is, and it's a very different sense of who the enemy is and what that means. And that's encouraging. And so we'll see basically where that goes.
One final thought, because I think people would find this of interest. I recall in one of your earlier books, you spoke about one of the ways of protesting against a fascist state is to create democracies in exile. Could you please explain that and give us some practical considerations for how people can
participate? I think that when you look at sanctuary, when you look at the sanctuary movement, when you look at people organizing food banks, when you look at people who are basically first responders who are doing everything they can to basically help people that they work with, when you look at churches and synagogues reaching out in communities and trying to mobilize a sense of hope and compassion, this is democracy in exile. This is what a democracy should look like. I mean, its first moment should be to reach out and to recognize that we're not alone, and we can't exist alone, and we can't exist simply in the grip of self-interest, and that we basically have to do everything we can to invigorate the social sphere by example. And it seems to me that more and more we see more and more movements working at a local level and then joining with larger movements to be able to say, look, there have to be alternative ways of living. Democracy has to have a human face. Democracy has to have a vision. Democracy has to have a sense of compassion. It has to believe in equality and social justice, and it has to recognize that our differences are our strengths, and that justice is what we need to take seriously. And we need to make that active. We need to make it visible, whether it's in a farmer's market or whether it's in a sanctuary church or whether it's helping undocumented immigrants or whether it's reaching out to the homeless and fighting to prevent, fighting to get housing, fair housing. I mean, these are all movements that contain a glimmer of what democracy should look like. And that's what we have to fight for.
I absolutely agree. Once again, Henry, thank you very much for coming on today. You've given us a lot of very powerful better understanding of our current crisis. A lot of people are confused, and they're looking for some light here, and you've given that. And people can read The Terror of the Unseen. That's one of Henry's new books. And also, I would suggest one of my favorite books of Henry Giroux is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. His website is henryagiroux.com. Giroux is G-I-R-O-U-X. And he's just one of the nicest people you ever want to meet. And he is a deep thinker. And that's why we had him on in part of our conversations with Remarkable Minds. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.